Hi Ananta, thank you so much for taking out the time to speak to me today. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you, Jerusha?
I'm doing wonderful. Thank you so much for asking. For our listeners, they would love to know a little about you and your background and how you got into Web3. Can you tell us a little about that?
Sure. My background, I was initially part of the initial team which built Oracle. So I go a long way back
Right.
and initially worked with databases and building databases and stuff like that. Then I was at Anderson Consulting, managing how to use technology and how to use technology effectively to help businesses. And I was a partner with Anderson for a long time and moved on to Accenture
Okay.
and got started on this journey around 2017. And the primary purpose was to really see how you can use this technology to add value to businesses, enterprises, and users alike, right? That's the genesis of my interaction in 2017. So, and the excitement was around the ability to provide people with the ownership and control of their technology in a way, so which is decentralized. So, provide the ability for the organization to customize their experiences the way they want for their users, and finally, even governments and regulators to manage and provide services to individuals and customers in a personalized fashion. That's what got me looking into this technology.
Awesome. So you go a long way back, and you worked, throughout the spectrum in Web 2 as well as Web 3. So what kind of drew you more towards Web 3? Like you've already mentioned how you want the users to have that prerogative. But can you elaborate a little more on this? Because this is something that I find very interesting. How do people take that leap from the comfortable place of Web 2, where there's everything known and there's always the discourse is already there, and to into Web 3, which is a pretty much a very new space.
Yeah, so the way I looked at it, at least, was just to go back and look at how technology is evolved, right? So if you look at how technology is evolved early on, it was used more like a utility or an automation tool, right? In the 1950s and 60s, you had
Right.
technology printing stuff, right? It was more like in programmable calculators. So it allowed you to print payrolls. It was more a very accounting, automation, efficiency-centric model. Then, so computers were standalone at that time, if you want to think of those mainframe and databases, even before databases, right? Mostly individual machines and accounts, and there was no recognition of a customer or a participant in that setup. Then, in 1970s, around that time, you have this whole idea of TCP/IP which came in, right? So,
Right.
what that did was really to have computers were able to talk to each other. Right, so two computers were able to talk to each other, and
Right.
that opened up a lot of new capabilities. So, once to think of it in a very simple way, if Tarosha was in one computer as one account doing a payroll in a payroll application, and you were in a different machine in a different ERP application, previously you couldn't be. They couldn't talk to each other. Your program couldn't recognize you on both the machines. Now, the TCP/IP, now you could be recognized on both the machines. So, the idea of a customer and network of computers came in. And that's where the whole idea of networking and web started, right? So, the ability for computers to talk to each other. So, that opened up a lot of customer-centric applications.
Right.
Initially, it was account-centric and it became customer-centric. So, what it did was now we were able to support newer and newer capabilities, which supported new things, which moved away from just automation and efficiency, right? We started communicating through computers. So it was getting closer and closer to our lives. So if you think of it, Web 1 and Web 2, computers were becoming more of a supporting artist, not an automation artist. So it's getting more and more and closer to your life. And fast forward to maybe the last 10 years or so, and maybe much faster in the last 5 years, computers have become much more closer to our lives. We no longer connect by technology, we operate by technology, right? So this whole notion of we eat by technology, we read by technology. So you're getting to a model where computers are no longer supporting artists. They are becoming a main artist in our life. Digital is becoming the way we live our lives. So this is what intrigued me, right? So the use of technology has changed, but the technology is not changed. So when it gets closer and closer to a human being,
right,
the primary need is personalization, privacy, and control, right? So that's, and if you look at it, webs in the early stages, customers were not even recognized. In the next maybe 30, 50 years in web one and web two, customers were recognized, but still the control is with the enterprise or the platform.
Right.
And now you're doing more intimate and personal and closer things. You live your life through technology.
Right.
So the control needs to be with the individual, and that's where Web3 is taking us to, right? That's the reason Web3 is becoming very relevant.
Absolutely. I think that it's become very imperative, and a lot more people are talking about this now. I think as against, you know, perhaps like even 5 years earlier, a lot more people are talking about how users should have control over their data and how what is exactly going to stay online. And it's like an interesting turn. I think that is just how technology is evolving. And I do think this is a very potent place where, you know, a lot more user interest is also forming, not just builder interest.
Yeah, because the use of technology has changed, right? So, and so I need to be able to use the technology in my everyday life, and not just as an offline tool that I was using before. And what we call it as in 2017, I coined this word called a digitally interacting world, right? So we are moving to this digitally interacting model. And so different people's different preferences are different, right? And different situational preferences are different. That's how we live our lives, right? The way you talk in a community forum is not the same way you would talk in a coffee shop. It's not the same thing that you talk in a personal role, right? So it's all very different, and so human beings operate in a very context-aware and situational manner, and technology gets closer to how we live our lives.
Absolutely. And you kind of hit the nail on the head, I think, and that kind of brings me to, and I would love to know more about Server Labs and, you know, my own internet protocol that you know, guys are building, because I thought that was very, very interesting. And obviously for our listeners, I would love to give them some context here. It seemed to be addressing the inefficiencies perhaps in the current protocols. That is something very interesting. So could you elaborate a little more on that?
Yeah, the very heavy. I think today's Web3 protocols, if you want to think of it, it started with Bitcoin and even before that, right? We had some peer-to-peer systems like Napster and so this peer-to-peer system where you don't have a centralized controller, where all this Web3 revolution started, right? So previously it was client-server, so this peer-to-peer networking is where everything started. And so we have made a lot of progress. So the infrastructure is kind of decentralized now. But then the problem is it's a very system-centric model, right? So although the network is peer-to-peer, your interactions and your data and your trust models are still systemic and not personal. So if you look at the example I typically give is the way you... the amount of trust and the how you want the network to behave and pay for when you want to drink a cup of coffee at Starbucks is very different than when you want to interact and buy a house in, say, Beverly Hills, right? The kind of trust requirements, the kind of experience, the kind of time delay that you can take is very different, right? So today's Web3 networks don't do that. What they do is they're very systemic, they're not participant-centric. So what we mean by that is they don't allow foundational differentiation. It's not just about user ownership and control. It's about foundational differentiation based on context, on what level of trust I want, where do I want to store my data, who all need to be part of my interaction to finalize the value that's being transferred. Those kind of decisions are completely systemic today in Web3 systems. At Server Labs and in my own internet, the protocol is trying to make it very participant and user-centered. Right? So the first time, kind of in the last 50 years, we kind of have built a model where the computation itself is very participant-centric. So that allows you to kind of manage the environment the way you want, right? Today, probably even in Web3, while the infrastructure has been decentralized, still the systems control you. The network is a controlling entity. With Moi, we are trying to make a network an enabling entity. What I mean by that is it enables the user as opposed to be controlling the user. So another example that you can think of is the way you want to deal with your vacation photographs may be very different than the way you may want to deal with your legal documents. So today, that level of control doesn't have, either for the developer or for the end user. Obviously, it's all going to be driven by developers, but then they don't have the freedom to make the network behave the way they want, right? And so what we have done is we have fundamentally changed. Probably this is the last transformation that needed to happen in the digital world. We fundamentally changed the computation to be centered around the individual. So if you want to think of it today in all of computation, you are just an identity, right? What I mean by that is Tarusha is just a name and a name and an identity. You are just identified in the network. So you are just an attribute of the computation. So whereas what we have done is with this idea of contextual compute, and we have redefined how computation works, whereas you are understood, Tarusha is understood by the network, so you are able to enable the computation and not just an identity of the competition. So everything becomes participant-centric. Because everything is participant-centric, your computation is participant-centric, your trust management is participant-centric, your infrastructure is participant-centric. So it kind of enables the true human-like interaction that you can perform in today's world. So in a digital interacting society, that's what would be required is our thesis. And MOI is based on this whole idea of contextual compute. And we have built a new model called interaction state machines, which primarily drives around peer-to-peer interactions and allows user ownership and control. So it's very participant-centric model as opposed to a system-centric model at a very high level.
Okay. So, you know, just for our listeners and for me to understand this a little better, how is that different from, you know, the validator nodes that usually protocols set up?
Very good question. So obviously, you need validators in our network too, right? So let us understand why do we need these validators? Maybe then it become a little bit easier to explain this. So when you do a peer-to-peer transfer, assume you and I do a value transfer, right? That's what happens. If both of us do this transfer and nobody else needs to recognize this value, we both can write that in your notebooks and go home, right? We still connect and talk. We don't need anybody else to. We don't need anything more to be done. The reason why you need validators is because you're trying to recognize that value in the network, or somebody else can refer that value and do another transaction, if you want to think of it like. Right. So to do that, then you and I are alone should not be able to agree on the value. We both agree on the value, but a lot of other people need to write it so that there are other people. It's like you do a transaction and there are people who come as signatories, right? Witnesses who come and sign. So if you want to think of the validators, it's the value transfer happening between two participants, but then there are other people who really recognize that value so that that value becomes the benchmark for future transactions. That's why you need validators. Now the question is, we also have validators. The question is who in the network needs to be part of your interaction so that this value can be recognized by the entire network, right? Entire community. And that's the question. Today's network, what they do is Web3 networks is the entire network needs to be part of every interaction, okay? And that's a large problem, right? So if you want to think of it, if you and I are doing a transaction, a majority of the validators in the network need to witness that so that they can write it in all their notebooks so that the verifiability for future use is available.
Right.
That's the model. Now that becomes an albatross around the neck when the number of nodes go up. right? If you 50, they do two-thirds. Two-thirds of 100 is 66 nodes, but two-thirds of million is a lot more right. nodes, right? 66. So the amount of people who need to witness and participate in this, the validators, in this mm-hmm. value recognition becomes a problem as the network grows in yeah. size. But the whole idea of Web3 was to make it internet as more and more people part of it. That's where the security comes, right? So yeah. it becomes a conundrum, right? So today yeah. what has happened is people have made the network smaller. They have created layer twos and layer threes, roll-up chains, where the number of people who decide on this validation or number of validators go down to solve this problem. So who decides this is a very tricky problem. And that's what affects scalability and security in the Web3 network. That's been the challenge, that is the lacuna, and that's the problem that you're facing today as more and more transactions come in.
Right.
And what we have done is we have taken a completely different take. We have created this idea of participant-centric networking. So you have a bunch of validators who are like your own notary. The public, right? So, and I have my own notary public in the network, and we do it in a very effective way. But then they're all validators like any other validators. A bunch of validators come with you, a bunch of validators come with me, not the entire network. So we are able to achieve, and these validators keep changing. So we make sure it's random, it is not gamed and all that good stuff. So, right. so what happens is you get the impact of the entire million node network on each interaction, but not the entire network of validators need to come in. So this is what we call as a context. So every participant, based on their behavior, because you are executing a lot of transactions, I've got a bunch of validators associated with them, and I have a bunch of validators associated with me, and they come together and finalize. So this way I'm able to do concurrent finalities, right? So it becomes truly peer-to-peer when you and I are doing a transaction. Susan and Alina can do a transaction at the same time
right.
because the idea of validators is centered around the participant and not on the network. So right. the same set of validators. I hope the idea of validators is the same, but how do you associate it is where the difference is. In today's networks, it is very network-centric. The entire network needs to validate it. In our case, it is very participant-centric. So you can think of each participant having their own network, and those networks come together dynamically to finalize that value transfer.
So basically, think of like your network behaves a little like a lever, perhaps, pushing off the... like a lid of a pot, instead of perhaps using a screwdriver. Like, that's a weird analogy, but that's how I'm thinking of it.
The way to think of it is it is concurrent, right? So
yeah.
So if you today's problem is it's so much network centric
right.
that the entire network entire network needs to be part of every interaction. So the only thing you can do is what they do is they pack so many interactions into a block, but then you can only pack so much, right? It's very difficult. Whereas what we have done is we have split the network itself intelligently, so many interactions can concurrently happen at a peer-to-peer level. So because every interaction is independent, now you can think of it the points I made before, right? You can go and customize the interaction the way we want. You can choose where you want to store, because every interaction is independent. Whereas, because it's very participant-centric. Whereas right. in today's network, everybody, it's one size fits all, right? So it's a block which has got 100 interactions, all of them finalized, all of them needs to be verified by majority of the network, whatever the majority means, right? So so you're not able to split it up and make sure that it can work concurrently. So the way they've gone about technically and done is, you got the shard chains to break the entire network, but still it is systemic. It's not participant-centric. So it has got the same set of problems because you put on a lower chain, but the lower chain can only go so far, right? Then people are already talking about L3s and N4s. So the complexity builds in. So we have taken a completely different route, and I've said that everything is centered on the participants. So every participant has got their own set of validators, which they don't control. It is the same set of, it's from the same network. Understood. But then with that assignment, it becomes very easy for us to manage this in a very user-centric and participant-centric fashion. So as the network grows, actually throughput and performance grows in our network.
It will improve, very, right? Yeah.
Yeah, very, very counterintuitive, right?
So,
whereas in today's most of the network, system-centric networks, it will fall because that's the way you have designed it. So the size of the network becomes an albatross around the neck of performance, while the size of the network is important for security, right? So the idea of going to an Web3 world was to have millions of nodes, isn't it? To provide security, there are so many people. And that kind of becomes a problem because when the network grows, the size becomes a bottleneck to performance. So you got a trade-off between performance and security. Whereas in our model, that trade-off doesn't exist.
Right. So, you know, this is very interesting and it's, you know, it sounds very, very path-breaking. How is it different from zero knowledge proof? Like, I understand that like a bunch of validators and there are individuals who have validators and it's not the entire network that is getting in sync. But again, zero knowledge proof is a, obviously it's not the same, but it's a little similar, right? Because the entire network is not similar.
So let me, very, very good question. So the in our case, the entire network syncs. It's not that it doesn't sync. The power of the entire network is available in every interaction in a very smart way, right? If you want to think of it, it's a basic stochastic process. So it's like your exit polls in an election. Okay, so let me, it's not opinion polls, exit polls, in, which are fairly, fairly verifiable. Okay, so it's a fairly well-researched mathematical idea. So so the entire network gets the final data, the entire network's entropy, or the, when you say network, it is just the entropy of the network, right? So the randomness of the network needs to be in every interaction. We make sure that happens.
Right.
So it's happening. So it's not an, it's not a walled garden approach. So whereas when you go to an zero knowledge ZK rollups or an shard chain or a side chain, they're walled gardens. Shard chain's a little better, meaning the validators in the lower networks have no influence on the higher network, right? So they're walled gardens, they're layers. So for example, if I have a layer one network and I have a layer two ZK rollup networks, the validators in layer one network have no influence in the finality other than verifiability of the layer two network's final answers. So they're walled gardens. In our case, it's one network, right? So it's a one flat network. So it's a foundationally a better model because in a ZK rollup model, while the final answer can be verified, the process of getting to the final answer can never be verified because the validators in the higher order network will never be part of the rollups in the lower network. I hope I'm making my point.
So
let me give another example. In New York, in Port Authority, there are bus stations. Have you seen them? They're bus-based, right? A lot of buses come in and park.
Right.
And there are many bus bases like that. So you can think of the bus bases as roll-ups, okay? And the bus station as the main net. Now, obviously, when the bus comes in, when a bus people comes in, when the station can verify the trip sheet and figure out how many people traveled in the bus and how many tickets were issued, so which are like the final rolled up answers. But the conductor in the bus station or the bus will never be able to verify how the bus behaved on its journey, right? Whether there was the process of whether they left off some people, whether they stopped in all stations. So the whole idea of the process by which you got to the final answer can never be verified. Only the final answer can be verified.
Right.
Which is a very, very weak model, right? It is not the promise of Web3. The promise of Web3 is, hey, I not only verify the answer, I also make sure your process is democratic and decentralized, right? So it's right. A walled garden approach. In our case, that's not the case. So if you have a million nodes, the number of anybody can be part of any interaction. So, and so you can, your potential opportunity to be, to verify that, right? So, yeah. So foundationally, that
is so strong that this opportunity to scale is higher with your network, correct?
Yeah. So it's a scale is very high, but we don't have to compromise on the security. Today, in an, it can scale while maintaining security. That's at a, so today, if you go to the lower chain, the right. Lower chains are walled gardens. So they have 100 nodes, 200 nodes, and obviously the consensus mechanisms have got their own limitations. You cannot scale beyond a certain point. That right. Is just and so this how do you do that?
Yeah.
That's just a mathematical problem, right? It's a quadratic problem. After a certain number of communications, number becomes very large. So right. and so how do you do it? So we have a very flat network, like today's internet is what MOA is. Whereas the end state that we are envisioning is millions of nodes like today's internet, but people transferring value in that network. So today's internet does it very well, but it transfers only information. It doesn't transfer value, right? You can send an email, but you can't send money in today's internet. And so what MOA is trying to do is make it as democratic to participate as it is in today's network, which is like anybody can come in and put on value and become a validator. And it is flat. You can be part of any interaction. You're not a walled garden. You don't have to be in a layer 2 or layer 3 chain. And so it acts like today's internet, but for value transfers in a very like a flat million node network. Plus, it eliminates the centralization problems of today's internet around the platforms by making the whole thing peer-to-peer. So if you want to think of it, it's today's internet-like structure on which you're able to do value transfers without the centralization challenges that we have today. So it's a peer-to-peer value, global value network is what we call it as.
Brilliant. So, this particular MOI, the network, the protocol, is the testnet live? Like, can users go and test it out? Is there a sandbox?
Oh, yeah. So we had our very large Babylon testnet launch happened last month.
On the 22nd of June.
So people can go check it out. It's very interesting. People can go build on top of that as we speak. There are other applications that we actually 3 or 4 major applications being built up. There is one infrastructure adaptive data management application called Moibit, which is very interesting, which is built on top of this. We have built a digital asset management platform called Mint Valley, which has been built on top of this. So it's a very differentiated take. It's very user centric because we are user centric and participant centric. And peer-to-peer, meaning not only does it make it humanized and personalized, but also solves some of the engineering challenges that we have today. But the goal is not just to solve the engineering challenges. The goal is to really create a network where it is personalized and user owns and controls the environment. And the offshoot of that is it solves some of the scalability and security problems that we have.
Awesome. This is like, because this is an entirely new protocol, and you've mentioned about these exciting applications being built. How are you incentivizing more developers to build on your protocol and now obviously to test out the testnet?
Yeah, so we have the testnet is today's incentivized. So actually, I don't know about other protocols. We have allocated about 10% of the tokens only for the community of developers and the validators as we speak. Right, so 10% is for the people to try it out. 10% of the entire token pool. So it's a very incentivized testnet. So people can go and test and try on top of that. And as they do that, they get incentivized. So that's one benefit. The other benefit for developers specifically is it's a very low code, no code environment. What I mean by that is it's not a very smart contract centric model. We have a lot of protocol level capabilities. So one of the largest problems for people getting into blockchain today is you need to be very careful when you write a smart contract so that there are no security vulnerabilities, right? So that so there is a large barrier to entry. So in our case, most of the digital assets and, are all at a protocol level. So for example, if you build an application, there are application tokens, and those application tokens get the same order of security like the protocol token, right? So to contrast this with something like Ethereum today, in Ethereum, you have ETH as the network token, which is highly secure. It's a protocol level token. But many of the application tokens are available, are hacked, and they're at the smart contract level. They don't get the same security of a protocol token. In our case, all the digital assets and application tokens are protocol tokens. So there's a high degree of security. And more importantly, many of the asset creation, token transfer, and all of that can be done using almost no code. Wow. Whereas many of the other protocols, you have to write smart contracts for it. Right. For example, to create a token, mint a token, manage a token, you will have to write at least 150 line code in other protocols. Here it is all built into the protocol itself. So that allows eliminates a lot of security challenges for early adopters, early developers. And so they're able to confidently build on top of the protocol. So that's another, although it's not a direct incentive, which allows a lot of people to get on and try, right? So they can actually do most of the asset management in any language that they want. So they can do it in JavaScript if they want to, creation of the asset, and they don't have to write smart contracts. They can write their code in JavaScript and do the asset management by making calls, which is very easy for developers.
Okay, so this is like sounding more and more interesting as we talk more about it. What are the kind of like partnerships that you are looking at in the Web3 space to make MOI like the go-to protocol where developers are building?
Yeah, so one is obviously we are working with some infrastructure providers to build support for validators, right? So our target is to have at least 10,000 validators by the end of the year, and our goal is to have about 500,000 validators in about 24 months. So we want it to be a very large network. So there is a lot of support that needs to happen for that. So we're partnering with quite a few infrastructure providers, and we are looking for other people who can come and help us do that, right? The other one is we are also a GTM where we work with schools and specifically colleges, college students, who we go and partner with them. We have a program called Moi Nation, which allows students to be part of this. We go create some knowledge sharing sessions and basically the idea of contextual compute, which is the foundational idea here, and our model is called interaction state machines, on top of which MOIS has been built. So we teach them those ideas. So there is a lot of ground up work that we do. So right. So there is enough people which we are training. So that's the other program that we have. The other one that we have is we have another program called Moi Shakti, where we want to specifically help entrepreneurial women to come and try on this new technology and build Web3. So that's another partnership that we're working on. And we also are working with quite a lot of community creators, right? So people who help build communities. So I don't want to name names, but we're working with quite a few of them to help community community, create communities, because without community, there's nothing. So that's going on as
well. Awesome. So right now, as you mentioned, the testnet is kind of live. So any user can perhaps, or developer can go on your website and take the testnet.
Yeah. So there is an, obviously, you can go register. There's a process. You can become a validator. So anybody with even a Raspberry Pi, right? So it's a very, can become a validator. It's a very interesting model. You don't need special purpose hardware at this point. You don't even have to stake anything, so you can go become a validator. So I would highly recommend anybody to go become a validator. It's an incentivized testnet, and try it out, and also collect some more tokens.
Awesome. I mean, that sounds wonderful. That sounds like a good opportunity for people to get in the space and also to make some potential money here. But awesome. This is brilliant. Tell me a little about, okay, so this is something that I've been asking people of late, because, you know, AI has become so big. You know, of late, there's a lot of noise. Like, there was a lot of noise about blockchain a few years back. Now it's about AI. How do you see these two technologies, you know, merging or perhaps working together? Do you see that happening at all? Or what is your take?
Yeah. So if you look at my first paper, I'd say, right, wrote in 2017, I call this model as ICT, right? Intelligence, communication, and trust. That's where a digitally interacting world is going. So what is happening is the communication is going to happen around all these new devices that's coming, right? You're getting a lot of devices. Every device is going to have a chip, right? They talk about cars being validators, the phones being validators, right? So every device is going to, so that's the communication aspect. So then you need a trusted layer on top of this, which manages the data and value, right? The intelligence can work only on a trusted layer of data. So the trusted layer is probably going to be blockchain. So it's highly complementary. And then AI intelligence is going to sit on top of that. So we call it as the ICT model, right? So intelligence, communication, and trust needs to come together. So blockchain becomes this trusted data management layer, because you're going to work and develop intelligence from anonymous or non-human, a lot of non-human sources, right? Every device is going to transmit its data. So it's all the more important that the AI, which relies on this data, relies on a data from a layer which is trusted, and blockchain potentially is going to become that layer on which AI can work on.
So, yeah, this is like a take that I've heard from a lot of people, and I feel I have a similar take, because AI is creating all kinds of content and all kinds of information and misinformation. Yeah. You know, blockchain would have a huge part to play.
Absolutely. AI and blockchain go hand in hand, right? You need the data infrastructure for AI to work well. So actually, we have a very interesting project that I'm writing a paper now, which is around using AI and blockchain to solve some of the problems around DeFi, right? So. Right. So and so use in our in MOI, because all assets natively sit at the participant level. The assets never leave the participant and go to a smart contract. It always sits at the participant level. So we can use AI to do price discovery, and the matching will happen through AI. But once the matching happens, the transfer directly happens in a peer-to-peer level. We call it a safe DeFi. It's like Today, if you look at something like Uniswap, which is a very good platform, but then the discovery or the order book is inside the smart contract. Your asset needs to move in there, and that creates all sorts of problems, right? So we are building a product which is called Safe DeFi, where the assets primarily sit with the participant, never leaves the participant, but the order book is driven through AI, right? So for example, you say that you want to trade 1,000 tokens of some token X, and I'm willing for some price, and I want to buy it at another price. That intelligence is managed through AI, but really you don't have to pledge your tokens until you really trade in a peer-to-peer fashion. So that's a very specific use case of AI and blockchain that we are bringing in to solve some of the problems in DeFi.
You know, this is very fascinating, and I feel that use cases like this, like these, basically make it even more encouraging for the end user to perhaps look into it a little more seriously.
Yeah. Because
solving their problem.
Yeah, because when you transfer today value, smart contracts are great, they become the intermediary now, right? So our idea is to make the participant the intermediary and have the code just help him do what he wants to do in a peer-to-peer fashion. So that kind of takes the stress away from the developer, because the assets always sit at the participant level. And they focus on writing logic, which makes it kind of a little bit more easier on the security standpoint. Because frankly, some of these smart contracts are the largest banks in the world today. So because all assets sit inside them. While it's decentralized and it's good, you just have a high degree of reliance in the security aspects of it. So using AI and participant-centric asset management, like what Moi is doing, we can reduce quite a bit of that risk.
Yeah, that's awesome. So we've talked a lot about what MOI is trying to build. What is the next big thing for you guys? Like, when do you guys plan to launch the mainnet?
Yeah, so we have a couple of more releases before the end of the year. So our mainnet is slated for the first quarter, actually January of 2024. So we have built the entire stack ground up at Arusha, right? So we have written our own networking layer. We have written our own language, which is called CocoLang, which is very specifically built for digital asset management. We have built our own execution environment. So the entire stack is built ground up. It's fully new. So we have multiple releases. We have been doing this over the past, year and a half. We had a release last year, which was called Indus, which was Indus testnet that's been running for almost 9 months. So we had the Babylon testnet, which added new features in June. And we have a couple of more releases coming between now and December. And the mainnet is with all the capabilities will be ready in January. Having said that, people can build quite a lot of things today on the network, because it is just more sophistication, more testing that needs to happen between now and December before, so it's a continuous process. But the TGE and the mainnet launch in a formal fashion happened in January.
Awesome. And that's very exciting. This entire, it's a new protocol. It's a new way that you're thinking technology. It's like a new another analogy. It's like a new token standard altogether, right? Like,
So we have a new digital asset standard. So we have taken the idea of, you want to think of it, we have taken participant and put them inside computing, right? So you look at it, today compute drives the participant. We are making the participants drive compute. So that's where, so it's a foundationally different take, and we believe that's what is required for a digitally interacting society, to humanize the network and support the kind of heterogeneous needs everybody wants, right?
Brilliant. This is absolutely awesome. Moving, a little away from and zooming out from your product to the market in general, what do you feel would bring on the, next bull run? What would be the factors in, what you believe would actually pull the market from this bear run to the bull run?
Yeah, one thing is obviously we'll have to make it a lot more simple for people, right?
Right.
I think there is still blockchain is considered very complex, right? So I think that shift from an engineering focus to a user focus probably is one big thing that is required. And two is probably make it work with existing systems, right? While everything can become Web3, Web2 is real. There's a lot of investments that's been made. So how do you practically move from Web2 to Web3, right? Those are two big things I would say are required for us to really move the needle. Right? One is make it simple so users, it becomes very easy for users. So kind of keep all the complexity at the back. Mm. And two is allow enterprises and businesses, show them a path to practically move from Web 2 to Web 3. And because if you don't do that, I think every application today, which is in Web 2 or the use case, cannot one fine morning move to Web 3. Right? It's not what happens. So that's for Web 2 and Web 3 need to coexist. So we need to have a practical path of moving it forward.
I think those are, you know, wonderful insights. I feel pretty much I concur with both of them. I think, you know, right now, user onboarding is very, very tedious when it comes to Web3, and that needs to change. And only once that starts changing slowly would we see more people coming in, and perhaps the market will become a little less volatile with more people and, you know, substantial solutions and solutions that are actually effectively solving a user's itch in some way. That is what essentially going to pull this market out from where?
Yeah, so I call it as, at least that's what we focus on, what is practical change management. So I've been around this space quite a bit. Great technologies are good, but then but change management is always the tough part, right? So so we need to figure out, we as a community and as part of the industry, we need to figure out how do you practically allow people to progress from Web 2 to Web 3, right? That's honest. Yeah. Practical change management will be key, right? So you can't go to enterprises and demand everybody move to Web 3. People are still working on mainframes.
Yeah, exactly. That is what I was about to say, that, you know, it just doesn't happen like that. Oldest technology, which you'd call ancient perhaps by the now standards, people are still working on that. So it has to be a gradual process, and you need to make it a little more far reaching and easy. That is the most important. You know, it's been such a lovely conversation talking to you. I was so curious to understand what you are building that, you know, I've almost lost track of time. We are running out of time now. So I'd like to perhaps wrap up, but not without asking you this one question that I ask everybody who comes on this show. If somebody is from Web 2 and, you know, perhaps peering into the Web 3 world, what would be your top two suggestions for them to start living on blockchain?
Blockchain is real and it's useful. That's the first thing, right? And two, be patient. Things of this magnitude take time to happen, right? So people are, those are two top suggestions I would give, right? It's real. It had tremendous value, both the user and the businesses. And so, and that's been demonstrated, and we can, and there's a lot of value. That's one. And two, we let us stay patient, right? So it is, changes of this magnitude take time. So it's not going to be an instant win, but then obviously it's a foundational shift. It is going to put your user in control. It's going to give them flexibility. It's going to provide privacy and transparency. Mm. It's going to, so all the good things that you're looking for to provide to an enterprise end users, blockchain can enable, right? So, so if you want to think of it, it is like the TCP/IP move, where we move from individual machines to machines which are talking to each other. Mm. Now, it is that big, so obviously,
you owe it to yourself, right? You owe it to yourself to learn a little about.
It's really, really interesting idea. So it's empowering, foundationally, it empowers individuals.
Absolutely.
That's always a good thing.
Right. Absolutely. You're all for empowering individuals. Thank you so much, Anantha, for taking out the time, speak to me about this. This is very interesting because it introduced me to this new protocol, and I'm going to try it right after this conversation. I'm going to sign up on the website. How this is, because the way MOI is coming across, it seems like a paradigm shift in the way protocols are right now working, and that is always interesting, like going from zero to one. So definitely going to try it, and I would encourage the listeners who are developers and builders to please check it out, especially because they have a no code space as well, and it'll be easy to deploy without taking too much of your time. So before we wrap this up, Anant, any parting thoughts?
No, I think what we're trying to do at MOI is to empower the individual and create an internet which is person, place, user owned. So this journey cannot happen with everybody participating in it. It's not just about the technology, right? It's about making sure the digitally interacting society is going to be equitable and sustainable. So that's the higher order growth. So I think I would really request everybody to try to participate and give us the feedback. So MOI is just a technology which is trying to make the digital society more an equitable place. So we welcome everybody's participation.
Awesome. I'm sure that our listeners would be wanting to check out your website and the protocol itself, especially considering yoga, it's going to be quite lucrative if they are right now and for them as well. Apart from the financial incentive, I think any new technology is such a paradigm shift when you bring in any protocol at a protocol level. I think that's worth testing out, and with your vast experience, I can only hope for really good things for your protocol, and I wish you all the best. Thank you so much for taking out the time to speak to me.
Thank you, Tarusha. Appreciate it.